3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast. Episode 80, A Test of the System. I have now given you all my take on the history of the space race in 79 not always so concise episodes. For today's episode, I am going to address a top-level fundamental question. So what? What does the space race tell us? Fair warning that this episode is going to be a little bit unlike prior episodes. Prior episodes were largely a narrative of history with some opinions. This episode will mainly be opinions sprinkled with some history. Getting on to the topic for today, many points and lessons can be taken from the space race, but I am going to focus on just one. On November 21st, 1962, President Kennedy met with key members of his administration who were in charge of the space program. This included NASA Administrator James Webb, NASA Deputy Administrator Hugh Dryden, NASA Deputy Administrator Robert Siemens, Director of the Manned Spaceflight Center, Bernard Holmes, Special Scientific Advisor to the President, Jerome Wiesner, and Vice President Lyndon Johnson, among others. The discussion during this meeting concerned the space race and the priority that the United States should be giving to landing men on the moon before the end of the decade. There is a declassified tape of the entire over 1 hour long conversation. The recording provides an incredibly frank view of presidential decision making. Indeed, it was in this conversation that President Kennedy candidly stated that he was only willing to spend so much money on the Apollo program only if the United States could get to the moon first, because he was, quote, not that interested in space. In an earlier part of this conversation, President Kennedy articulates exactly why he was willing to commit so many resources to the Apollo program. The Soviet Union has made this a test of the system, so that's why we're doing it. That is what President Kennedy said. By a test of the system, President Kennedy is referring to the conflict at the core of the Cold War. One government, the Soviet Union, established based on a communist-based economic system ruled by oligarchic authoritarianism versus another government, the United States, established on a capitalist economy system ruled by a federal democratic republic. Which of these two systems was superior? That is the central question that President Kennedy said the space race would answer. So let's try to answer that question. Now there are two ways to answer the question. The simple way and the complicated way. The simple way is to say that the United States landed men on the moon first. Because the United States won the space race, the system championed by the United States is superior. End of story. Obviously, though, we are not going to go with the simple answer today, or this wouldn't be much of an episode. Indeed, there wouldn't really be much of a reason for the podcast. The complicated answer to the question will point out that there is no fair or scientific way to compare the Soviet Union and the United States. And to a degree, I do agree with this. In order to make a fair comparison of the two countries in the race to the moon, we would need to control for a number of factors that we know are not controlled for. For example, we would need to control for the economic, industrial, and technological capabilities of the Soviet Union and the United States at the start of the race. Ideally, they would be equal for a fair comparison. But obviously, they were not equal. As I covered in the very early episodes of this podcast, we must remember that the Second World War still loomed very large over both nations at the start of the space race in the late 1950s. I mean, President of the United States was Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander who led the D-Day invasion. The Second World War totally devastated the Soviet Union in a way that is now difficult to imagine after over 75 years without another conflict on the scale of that war. I think President Kennedy provided one of the best summaries of the war's effect on the Soviet Union during his American University commencement speech in June 1963, which I quoted back in episode 26 when I talked about the possibility of a joint moon landing.
And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago.
By contrast, the United States exited the Second World War as the world's sole superpower. The United States was the only nation with atomic weapons, and it had a massive fleet of strategic bombers to carry those weapons anywhere in the world, supported by the largest navy in the world. Not to mention, the United States' industrial and agricultural centers had been totally untouched by the Second World War. So much so that American factories, farms, and finances would soon be buttressing the rest of the world from a cruel winter and harsh economic conditions under the Marshall Plan. Although the economic and industrial might of the Soviet Union had recovered significantly by the time of Sputnik in 1957, it could not compare to the United States, which never had to undergo any recovery in the first place. Remember, as I discussed in the first few episodes of this podcast, the United States could have launched the first artificial satellite if it had chosen to do so. The United States had the rocket lift capability. It simply chose not to prioritize the launch of a satellite. After Sputnik, when the United States did prioritize the launch of a satellite, the United States was able to do so with a Redstone rocket, a rocket that had been in the United States inventory for years at this point. Then there were the technological differences. In part because American industry had not been attacked during the Second World War, the United States had been able to devote more resources to research and development of new materials and new technologies. This investment into technological development, long before the space race began, was a key factor in the United States reaching the moon first. For example, I talked at length during the podcast about the importance of the F1 engine used to power the first stage of the Saturn V rocket, as well as the importance of the upper stages fueled by liquid hydrogen. Research into these items requires years of lead time. And in fact, the United States had started research into what would become the F1 engine and research into liquid hydrogen fueled rockets before the space race ever started, making these technologies available during the race itself. By contrast, the Soviet Union had done barely any research into hydrogen-fueled rocket engines, and the Soviet Union had not invested in the development of large rocket engines like the F1. This was the reason why, after all, the first stage of the N1 rocket had to be powered by 30 separate engines. Then we must also account for the political factors that make a comparison between the Soviet Union and the United States unfair if the only metric for superiority is landing on the moon first. The United States was always significantly more motivated to land on the moon first than the Soviet Union. President Kennedy had made a special address to Congress in May 1961 just to lay out his plan and direct the United States toward the moon. The United States then devoted billions of dollars to accomplishing this task without much deviation. The Soviet Union, by contrast, was a bit more ambivalent about its motivations. Certainly, Sergei Korolev wanted the Soviet Union to commit to going to the moon, but the records we have indicate that the Soviet government did not back a moon landing program until 1964, 3 years after the United States had fully committed itself to that endeavor. And then, even after the Soviet Union authorized Korolev's moon landing effort, the resources that the Soviet Union devoted to the effort were always significantly less than what the United States was giving to NASA. So a one-to-one comparison between the Soviet Union and the United States in the space race doesn't really seem possible. Who is to say if the economic and political system of the Soviet Union would not have been able to reach the moon first if the Soviet Union simply had the same starting industrial and technological capabilities as the United States? But there are some important lessons that can be drawn from the space race. At its most fundamental level, the space race presented the Soviet Union and the United States with a monumental engineering problem. That is fundamentally what landing men on the moon was, an engineering problem. This was not a social problem, like solving poverty or racial justice, which would require us to account for differences in culture and history and so forth. As an engineering problem, it is just a thing that needed to get done. So, in a way, the space race was a good test of the respective systems. Although the Soviet Union and the United States started their moon landing programs at different times and gave their different levels of effort, we can still draw two main lessons. One, how the Soviet Union and the United States planned to address the engineering problem, and two, how the Soviet Union and the United States dealt with setbacks and failures, which frankly will inevitably be encountered in any massive undertaking, engineering or not. Let's start with the first lesson. How did the Soviet Union and the United States plan to address the engineering problem of landing men on the moon and returning them safely to the Earth? Well, in the United States, the government decided way back in 1958 under the Eisenhower administration to centralize all space programs for management by a single federal agency. As I mentioned way back in episode 4 when I introduced NASA, prior to 1958, each branch of the military, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, had their own programs for manned spaceflight. In 1958, the Eisenhower administration centralized all of these efforts into a single agency known as the Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA. All of the non-military space programs were then transferred to the newly established NASA. This centralization of the nation's space programs did much to eliminate wasteful government spending on parallel space programs managed by different entities. Of course, the centralization of the United States space programs into ARPA and NASA occurred before the nation committed itself to landing on the moon in May 1961 under the Kennedy administration. Nevertheless, the United States never backed away from this centralized coordination. Throughout the space race, there was never any question in the United States that NASA, and NASA alone, would lead the nation's effort to land on the moon. No other agency, like the Air Force or some other agency, ever tried to take over. The same could not be said of the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, Sergei Korolev started as the undisputed leader of the nation's space programs. But that very quickly changed. Most infamously, by 1959, a feud started between rocket designer Sergei Korolev and rocket engine designer Valentin Glushko. This forever split two key great minds of the Soviet space industry, and accordingly divided the government's attention and resources into what would eventually be parallel rocket development programs for launch vehicles that had similar performances. Then we must also account for other engineers who entered into the fray to get a piece of the nation's space program efforts, such as Vladimir Chelemy and Mikhail Yangel. When the Soviet Union finally committed itself to landing cosmonauts on the moon in 1964, the situation did not change. In fact, it worsened. Rather than concentrating the nation's space programs into a single entity, the Soviet government consciously decided to split the programs among different designers in some kind of political balancing act. As I covered in episodes 37 and 38, the Soviet Union placed the moon landing effort under the direction of Sergei Korolev, using the N1 L3 launch vehicle and spacecraft complex. But the effort to complete a manned circumlunar flight was simultaneously transferred from Korolev and his Soyuz program to Vladimir Chelemy and his proposal for the LK-1 spacecraft. So even though a manned landing on the moon and a manned circumlunar flight around the moon would both very likely involve the same or similar technologies and launch vehicles, the Soviet Union decided to place these efforts under the control of two rivals who did not share their technical know-how or cooperate in any way. But that wasn't even the end of it. Korolev and Chelemy were never comfortable letting the other have a piece of the nation's space program. So when Chelemy's star fell after Nikita Khrushchev was removed from power in October 1964, Korolev made a play to take back the manned circumlunar flight program as part of his Soyuz L1 effort. And in this, Korolev succeeded. But then Chelemy took advantage of Vasily Mishin's weakness after Korolev died by trying to take over the moon landing effort with his proposal for the LK-700, which I discussed in episode 49. Although Chelemy never succeeded in subverting the N1 L3 moon landing program, his alternative proposal for the LK-700 continued to remain a threat whenever the N1 L3 program encountered problems. For example, as I covered in episode 59, when the N1 rocket started to encounter delays in 1967, some members of the Soviet government asked Chelemy to resubmit his alternative proposal for the LK-700. Though by then, even Chelemy understood the difficulties involved in beating the United States to the moon and wasn't very interested. This dog-eat-dog world of the Soviet space program only came to an end in 1974 when, as I discussed last time, Valentin Glushko came in and took over the entire space industry and kicked out Vasily Mishin. The centralization of the nation's space efforts into one agency in the United States and the decision to maintain rival power centers controlling different aspects of the nation's space efforts in the Soviet Union is, I think, one of the main reasons that the space race ended with the United States landing on the moon first. So it might follow that this is one factor that would show the capitalist Federal Democratic Republic form of government advocated by the United States during the Cold War was superior to the communist, oligarchic, authoritarian form of government championed by the Soviet Union. But to really come to this conclusion, there is one further question to consider. Whether there was something about the nature of the two systems that made the United States centralize its efforts while the Soviet Union did not. Let's start with the United States as a representative for capitalist democratic republics. I think it will surprise no one to say that democratic forms of government are not exactly known for being organized in an efficient, coherent, or logical manner. And certainly the lack of a centralized agency to handle a specific topic of national importance happens in democratic republics. Probably the best example of this is the way the United States organized intelligence agencies before the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. Different intelligence and law enforcement agencies each held a piece of the puzzle and had not shared that information. But that said, after the September 11th attacks, the United States did reorganize its intelligence agencies and established an entirely new cabinet-level department to address the issue. This might be analogized to the United States space programs being disorganized and allotted among different branches of the military until after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik in 1957. The sudden shock of a Soviet satellite shook the American public and, like the September 11th attacks, galvanized the United States government into organizing NASA to provide a centralized agency for a coherent response. So the takeaway here is that while democratic governments are not necessarily organized in a logical manner, they are, if the United States is to be taken as a proxy, capable of getting themselves organized properly to tackle a problem in response to a shocking event or the realization of the need to coherently address a problem. Now, let's turn to the Soviet Union as the representative for communist, oligarchically ruled authoritarian governments. So we know the Soviet Union failed to centralize its space programs for coherent management of the effort to land on the moon. But was there something inherent in the nature of the Soviet Union's form of government that prevented that kind of centralization that occurred in the United States? I think the answer is actually yes. In an oligarchically ruled authoritarian form of government, power often lays within personal relationships rather than formal government relations. We saw, for example, how Vladimir Chelemy was able to gain some attention for his space proposals through an informal connection with Nikita Khrushchev, since Khrushchev's son worked for Chelemy. I also talked about a number of times when Chelemy's space proposals were repeatedly sidelined because Dmitry Ustinov, the Minister of Defense Industries and Space, simply didn't like Chelemy. So I submit that one reason why the Soviet Union did not manage to organize a centralized space agency like NASA early in the space race, or even after 1964, when the Soviet Union affirmatively decided to land on the moon, was the fact that any centralization would have necessarily insulted one powerful leader or another, and implied a rise or fall in political strength. For example, if the space programs had been centralized under Korolev, Khrushchev probably would have felt slighted. But if the programs had been centralized under Chelemy, Ustinov probably would have felt slighted. Better to split the aspects of the space program among different individuals to balance political power and keep the peace. This was unlike the United States, where formal government relations, rather than personal relationships, was where primary political power lay. For example, I mentioned in the podcast how the U.S. Army resisted the transfer of the Army Ballistic Missile Agency and Wernher von Braun to NASA. But at the end of the day, the transfer happened. It happened because President Eisenhower didn't have to worry about keeping some general in the U.S. Army happy. He was the president. He could organize things the way he wanted, and in accordance to what Congress had mandated when it established NASA. This was unlike Khrushchev, who had to make sure people like Ustinov were kept happy due to the importance of informal power structures in the Soviet Union. So if we are talking about a test of the system, I think one possible lesson is that the capitalist democratic form of government championed by the United States has more flexibility to get itself reorganized to address a major problem than the communist, oligarchically ruled authoritarian government represented by the Soviet Union. Though, of course, opinions may and will differ. The second major lesson that can be drawn from the space race, if interpreted as a test of the system, is the way the Soviet Union and the United States responded to setbacks and failures. In an undertaking as large and complex as landing men on the moon, setbacks and failures are almost inevitable. So I think seeing how each government reacted to setbacks and failures is a very good test of the system. Let's start once again with the United States. The United States had no shortage of setbacks and embarrassments at the start of the space race. Right at the outset, the United States had to deal with the failure of the Vanguard rocket to launch the first American satellite, followed by the repeated failure of the Pioneer satellites aimed at the moon. Then, after NASA was organized to take over, the embarrassment continued with one failed Ranger probe after another. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union beat the United States by sending the first man into space. Then the Soviets did the first EVA. And then, of course, we get to 1967, when we have the single greatest setback for NASA, the Apollo 1 fire. Each of these failures and setbacks exposed NASA and the United States government to criticism. The public and the press debated agonizingly over the causes of the failure and what should be done to fix them. What is remarkable about all of this is that the failures were discussed so openly. Although NASA and the government definitely tried to spin events to minimize failure or put the failures into context so they didn't look so bad, there was never really an effort to hide them. The closest thing I ever saw was the proposal from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to rename or renumber the Ranger probes after encountering numerous failures. What is perhaps just as remarkable is that despite the setbacks and failures, the public generally continued to support the space program throughout the first half of the 1960s, even if the public didn't always think NASA was doing the best job. And NASA and the government, for their part, never backed away from the commitment of landing men on the moon. NASA and the United States were able to absorb public criticism, and that criticism might actually have led to improvements in the efforts to land on the moon. The Soviet Union similarly had no shortage of setbacks during the space race. Many of these setbacks, however, are not widely known. The Soviet Union had a widespread practice of actively hiding any failed missions. For example, in Episode 3, when I talked about the United States and the Soviet Union's early efforts to launch probes to the moon, I explained how the United States launched 4 Pioneer probes to the moon in 1958, all of which failed. Then, in 1959, the Soviet Union stunned the United States with Luna 1, the first probe to do a flyby of the moon, and then Luna 2, the first probe to hit the moon, and Luna 3, the first probe to return photos of the backside of the moon. This narrative makes it appear as though the Soviet Union was far more capable than the United States. But what the public did not know was that the Soviet Union had been trying to launch probes to the moon in 1958 just like the United States. The Soviet Union launched 3 probes, in fact, and all of them failed to get there. And as I've mentioned throughout this podcast, whenever the Soviet Union attempted to launch a planetary probe or a spacecraft to the moon, and that probe or spacecraft failed to leave Earth orbit, the Soviet Union would designate that probe as Cosmos, rather than Venera, Luna, or some other name to indicate the intended purpose of the spacecraft. Instead, the Soviet Union pretended as though the spacecraft or probe was only meant to be a mere satellite around Earth to hide its failures. And when the setbacks to the Soviet Union became so public that they could not be hidden or denied, the Soviet Union started to give up. We saw this after NASA's success with the lunar orbital flight of Apollo 8. A manned circumlunar flight had been the Soviet Union's major goal, the one that the Soviet Union wanted to achieve by the 50th anniversary of the Soviet Revolution in 1967. When that could not be accomplished, and the United States beat them to a manned flight around the moon in December 1968, the Soviet Union started to look for another goal, one that was not centered around the moon. Later, when the Soviet Union finally did acquire the ability to launch a manned circumlunar flight, it did not do so. As I mentioned in episode 72 on Moonset, when the Soyuz 7KL1 was finally ready for manned flight in 1970, after years of effort and expended resources, the Soviet government refused to authorize a manned mission. To the Soviet government, the perceived sense of inferiority of such a mission when compared to the Apollo moon landings was too much to bear. So all that work was for naught. The Soviet Union's inability to take criticisms or accept perceptions of inferiority made it somewhat of a paper tiger. And as I thought about this, I was drawn more and more to something that Dan Carlin once said in the Hardcore History Podcast. In the Hardcore History Podcast, Dan Carlin made a comparison between the German army in World War I and the German army in World War II. And he described the German army of World War II as a paper tiger. Now, this would seem odd, but his point was that even though the German army of the Second World War was able to conquer France, which the German army of the First World War was never able to do, Dan Carlin pointed out that the German army of the Second World War couldn't take any hits. After Stalingrad and the loss of the German Sixth Army, the German army of the Second World War basically began to slow in a gradual retreat. Contrast this to the German army of the First World War, which suffered major defeats repeatedly and losses of hundreds of thousands of people at multiple battles of Verdun, and yet the army kept going. I find that a similar argument applies here to the Soviet Union during the space race. Sure, the Soviet Union got in some good jabs at the beginning with Sputnik, Yuri Gagarin, and the first EVA, but when the Soviet Union was tested with real resistance and encountered its first major setback with Apollo 8, it never recovered. And in fact, the Soviet Union just gave up. And this is a point that I want to emphasize. Because, as I said in the last episode, the United States won the space race in the narrow sense of landing men on the moon first. But there was no reason why the space race in the broader sense of a competition to improve outer space capabilities had to end there. Vasily Mishin, for example, had a plan for the construction of a large space station for a future mission to Mars, as well as plans for extended stays on the moon's surface. The space race in the broader sense ended only because the Soviet Union decided not to compete anymore. So, as to the second question I posed about which system was better able to deal with setbacks and failures, the capitalist democratic republic system advocated by the United States sure seems like a big winner over the communist oligarchic authoritarian system represented by the Soviet Union. But as with the first question here, we must also ask, was there something inherent in the nature of the government advocated by the United States that made it able to absorb setbacks and failures in a way that the Soviet Union could not? Here, I think the answer is also yes. The United States conducted all of its activities during the space race in the public, failures and success. In the open society that the United States advocated and represented, there was really no other choice. This had both positive and negative consequences. As President Kennedy himself said during his address to Congress in May 1961,
"We take an additional risk by making it in full view of the world. But as shown by the feat of astronaut Shepard, this very risk enhances our stature when we are successful."
The open nature of the government that the United States advocated meant the public was used to setbacks, and the government was able to absorb criticism without collapsing because criticism was par for the course. Even the Apollo 1 fire, serious as a setback as it was, did not change the nation's commitment to to landing on the moon. By contrast, the Soviet Union chose to keep most of its space programs a secret, rarely disclosing the activities unless it was impossible to hide or success had already been achieved. Theoretically, the Soviet Union did not have to do this. They could have conducted their space program in the open as well. But this would have been quite difficult, given the Soviet Union's unrelenting insistence that the communist system was better in every single way. An insistence that was so unrelenting that any setback or failure was not acceptable, lest a comparison be made to the United States. I also think that there is something inherent in the Soviet form of government that required failures and setbacks to be hidden. Because we can see this over and over again in Soviet history. The biggest example of this is the Chernobyl nuclear power disaster. The repeated lies told by the Soviet Union about the situation at Chernobyl repeatedly hampered any assistance that other nations could offer. And indeed, it was Chernobyl that led one Mikhail Gorbachev to rethink how the Soviet Union was governed and to favor glasnost, or openness. But once glasnost began, the Soviet Union's blemishes were revealed, and the government started to be held accountable for social and economic problems. And that eventually led to the entire government collapsing. Indeed, in final analysis, if one is to use the space race as a test of the system, I submit that the key lesson that can be taken away can be summed up in one term: accountability. The United States and NASA was constantly held accountable to the American public for both failures and successes. This led President Kennedy to commit the nation to landing on the moon to calm American fears of inferiority in space, and NASA to deliver on that promise. By contrast, in the Soviet Union, when it became clear that a Soviet cosmonaut was not going to land on the moon first, the Soviet government pretended like it was never trying to land on the moon in the first place. The Soviet government was able to do this because it didn't need to hold itself accountable to anyone for the massive amounts of resources already spent on the N1L3 program. That concludes the opinions I wanted to share on the lessons of the space race. But I don't want to end here on a note of comparison and competition. So I have one final episode as an epilogue to end on a note of cooperation. So join me next time as I discuss the Apollo-Soyuz test project.